Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies, 2018 style.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know how that happened.
But here it is. And we couldn't ask for a better guest to kick off the new year than Clifton Collins Jr. And we are so happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's exciting to be one of the first interviews of the year.
Well, and so I was saying to my dad, there's a reason why we are connected, the three of us. And it's two-part. You are connected to my dad because he knows your grandfather mm-hmm. and loves your grandfather. And you and I are connected because we come from family members that we are so incredibly proud of and love. We love keeping their history alive. We love hearing what people have to say about them. That's so nice. You know, I'm always so proud of him and everything that he does.
How could you not be?
And, right.
Oh,
right. But
shucks.
But when I listen to you talking about your grandpa, that I get it.
All right. Now, I'm gonna interrupt just to set the scene here. Now, you guys who are listening, I mean, you've seen Clifton in so many films and TV shows, Capote and Babel and Traffic and Pacific Rim and, you know, and
everything.
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 The first season of Westworld, on and on and on. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of that. But if you've never seen his granddad, Pedro Gonzalez Gonzalez, you got to go to YouTube. This is what you do. You go to YouTube and you type in Pedro Gonzalez Gonzalez. And the first thing that comes up is an episode of Groucho Marx's wonderful TV show, You Bet Your Life, from the 1950s. And he comes out looking like a dead ringer for you, the young version of your grandfather.
He said this to me this morning. He shows me his phone. He goes, they're the same. They are the same.
And he proceeds to absolutely convulse the audience and Groucho with his effervescent personality.
Yeah.
And his just the DNA, his performing gene. I don't know how else to describe it. And he made such a hit that Groucho had him back, had to have him back again at least once or twice.
One time for sure. I'd love to get my hands on that. I'm trying to find it right now.
Yeah. Well, at least it is on YouTube. And then he came to the attention of John Wayne, who fell in love with your granddad and put him under personal contract and kept him busy in films for quite a while during the 1950s. People remember Rio Bravo especially. Mm. And we'll get into all of that later on, too.
High and the Mighty One that you...
That's how I got to meet your grandfather, was when I did the audio commentary for the long unavailable film, The High and the Mighty, when it was finally released on DVD. It's so long. It's a 3-hour movie that we had members of the cast come at various points and do interviews as sections of the commentary track. And your grandmother and grandfather came into the audio recording booth, and it was just so neat to have them there and for me to get to meet him, having watched him so many years. So he's a very special person to me. And again, if you folks don't know him, that's okay. You can get to know him very quickly and easily.
And you should.
Thanks to the glories of YouTube.
Yeah.
And
watching him dance, and this is something that you're the reason that we now know that he danced. You showed us clips of him dancing.
Wow.
And he's not just like a guy that dances. He's a dancer.
Yeah.
Like properly a dancer. He's fantastic.
I got to show you guys the Jimmy Durante, Robert Mitchum episode. Where Grandpa's doing looks like breakdancing.
Is it real? Oh, my God.
1956, February 11th.
Now, what was his background, Clifton?
He got pulled out of the second grade after the family realizing that he was like the funny one of the bunch at mm-hmm. that young age of 7. Mm-hmm. And they started training them to play the musical bottles, the frying pans, a dance. And he started doing, that's where he brought the tramp character to life.
No. Does this mean your great-grandparents were also in show business?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. My great-grandfather was a trumpet player. My great-grandmother was a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
They were 9 brothers and sisters. They all performed.
And in traveling shows, in vaudeville?
It was like a Mexican vaudeville. It's called La Carpas,
mm-hmm.
Which was essentially a mobile tent show. It was like a mobile theater.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go from town to town to the local communities, especially where there was cotton picking, which was October, November, December.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when, those were the 3 months that the signs that said no Negroes, Mexicans, or dogs allowed would come down.
Mm-hmm.
And they would allow everybody to come in the front to eat because all the Mexican cotton pickers were, you know, hungry. And money seems to erase racism temporarily throughout the years in the history, from what I've noticed and the stories I've heard from my grandparents. So they would tour those towns, whether it be a dance hall or a ranch or a barn. And depending on how many workers, they'd do either 1 to 2 to 3 shows a night, ranging about a half hour each. But, you know, there's a lot of suffering in that time. You know, my grandparents would have to wait. I recently recorded her telling me this story about a midnight show they had to play. Which they were excited to play because they were making money. But then the owners of the restaurant made them wait for like 2 hours just to get their pay, which ended up being like $3 or $4 in the cold with my little mom, my uncle, and my aunt, just children. They all got the whooping cough afterwards. But they were like, you know, 17 and 19. And that was way before Groucho.
Wow. So they pulled him out of the second grade because he had talent.
Yes, sir.
And so... He grew up performing.
That's correct.
That's what he knew. That's what he knew how to do.
Mm-hmm. Which is why he couldn't read, much like Sammy Davis Jr., who was also pulled at the age of 7.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't really care about the education back then,
mm-hmm.
which is why Grandpa was so adamant about the grandchildren having an academic education on top of a creative performing education, which is how I kind of got into Loyola High School. through the Wayne family, coincidentally.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because my grades were terrible in the 8th grade. So he called Mike Wayne, the eldest son, rest in peace, and pulled a couple strings. Once I got in there, I got good grades, but getting there.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my. John Wayne presided over an extended family. Not a lot of people know this about him. He really did. I mean... He fell in love with your grandfather, and so he became part of that family. And there were other people that he kept on the payroll, other people that he just looked out for, and you've just given us another example.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. So interesting.
The Wayne family has been very good to us. He was also responsible for breaking one of his sisters... his sister's husband, who lived in Venice at the time, when they found out that there was a giant manhunt for my grandfather after the Groucho Marx show, because nobody could find him, he'd gone back to Texas, they contacted him through relatives in Venice, California, and those relatives deemed themselves the managers of my grandfather, taking 40% of his earnings. So when Grandpa went to Duke and says, hey, you know, Duke, you know, get a raise. He goes, raise, Pedro, what are you doing? He goes, I'm paying you every week. You're under contract now with Bat Jack Productions. He's like, oh, well, I've got, you know, William Morris, my agent, 10%. I got my manager, 40%. He's like, manager? He's, what do they do for you at 40%? He was like, oh, they drive me to set sometimes. That was really the extent of it. So Duke stepped up. And my grandfather never really wanted to, you know, cause waves in the water, so to speak, especially with the family.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very easily apt to just let it go and keep paying them. And Duke was like, you can't do that. And if they don't let you break that contract, then I'll sue them for back pay and get all your money back. Mm-hmm. So they let him out. And my grandpa said, just let him keep the money.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
He got robbed a lot as a young kid, not just by his own family, but... by people that would hire him for gigs because he was, you know, 17 years old, 19 years old.
The kid, yeah.
Unworldly, yeah. Uneducated, you know.
But talented.
But talented, yes.
Talented.
Well, and that, that's an old story, isn't it?
It certainly is.
And it goes on all the time. Even with people who are earning stratospheric sums of money, if they fall into the wrong hands, this is the result.
Still happening today.
Yeah. All the time. Yeah, of course.
So when did you decide? I've heard all these stories from my grandpa, and it sounds like a nightmare. I want to do that. I want to do what he does.
You know, if Grandpa could go through it, I could go through it. And I hear the stories. I'm like, really? You were on the road at 15 and 17? I mean, I talk to my other friends that are musicians or actors, and it's like I couldn't fathom. Being on the road. I mean, I ran away when I was 16, but to actually be on a bus traveling to New York to perform and audition with the Rockettes, you know what I mean, is a bit mind-blowing to be married at 17. which my grandfather did.
Oh, okay.
I didn't.
No. The visual in my head, though, of you and your grandpa joining the Rockettes, that's the one
I
want.
Well, I am writing the screenplay right now as we speak. I'm documenting so many of these stories.
Great.
On tape, as you would say.
Yeah.
you have to.
Yes, I've been typing every night.
Yeah, that's great. So how did you get started? What inspired you, besides the obvious inspiration of your family?
Well, there's even more obvious is, you know, I honestly think that we're all actors in different ways, shapes, and form, whether we're doing a presentation of ourselves for a boss or a girlfriend or a boyfriend or family members, or you're lying to a cop or who the hell knows. But in a professional sense, you know, it really came at a point in time when believe it or not, my grandfather was complaining how he had seven grandkids and none of them chose to follow in his footsteps because his career was unworthy. And I felt so bad because my grandfather and grandmother were pretty much the two paternal figures in my life that showed me unconditional love. Mm-hmm. So I had a special place for him as he did for myself. And it was at that point where I thought, well, gosh, somebody's got to be an actor in this family. Maybe it's my cousin. Maybe it'll be my sister. You know, they're both good looking, you know, so I've heard. So, but they were kind of into it, kind of not into it. My sister tried for a little bit. My cousin was like, no. And then I asked my grandpa, I said, geez, you know, I was teaching martial arts at the time. I was 16, going on 17. And I had, at that moment, I was thinking about it. I asked my grandpa, I said, what do you think, grandpa? And he says, of course you can do it. Yes, you can do it. He was the one voice that I needed to hear a yes from. Mm-hmm. And pretty much the only voice I heard, coincidentally. But at that time, I had so many different, you know, whether it was kids I was teaching or random people I'd run into the movie theater just asking me if I was an actor or if I did some acting, or I reminded them of Willem Dafoe or Robert Downey Jr. or, you know, all kinds of James Dean. I used to hear all kinds of things. But it was all within these little signs always pop up in like a 3-week to 4-week period for me. Yeah. And I get bombarded with just these alleged coincidences or serendipitous events. And when I asked Grandpa, he said yes. I said, okay, well, I knew this wasn't something I was going to try. I knew it was something I was going to do. And I knew it was a process. This isn't just I audition one time and then I'm an actor. It's not that. Mm-hmm. It's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle of committing to entertain for the masses. Mm-hmm. And I had been doing it in school. Mm-hmm. You know, the class clown, you know, rolling the dice for a good laugh versus detention. You know what I mean? If I got the good laugh, you know, sometimes they'd be sparing on the detention and sometimes detention would be the reward for the laughter. But I was entertaining this whole time. I just didn't know it. Mm-hmm.
And when did you turn professional? When and how did you turn professional?
It was a Say No to Drugs campaign, the irony. it was a week before my 18th birthday, and I was literally grandfathered in because my grandfather and grandmother had to drive me to sex. I was underage, and my mom had a job, and she didn't believe that I actually got a commercial anyway. She thought I was lying to her.
Oh, my God.
She's like, you got a commercial? Yeah, right. Oh, really? Then when's your wardrobe fitting? Dun, dun, dun. I was like, oh my God, wardrobe fitting. What is that? I was like, it's tomorrow, Mom. Let me talk to your grandfather. And then my grandpa got on the phone. I was like, no, I heard him in Spanish talking to my mom. He's like, no, he goes, darling, he goes, no, he got a commercial. No, he's not lying to you. He really did. He's getting a commercial and he's shooting. And I was like, wow, like even after I told her from my own mouth, she didn't believe me. She believed so little in me that, and my grandfather was the only one that did.
You had someone, though. I'm glad that you had somebody who means that much to you.
Yeah, that's the truth.
At least who is there. Yeah.
Very blessed, very blessed.
Now, I was looking at your credits, and you've got a lot of them going back a good many years.
It is comical looking up your credits.
I remember seeing you and taking note of you was in the wonderful Ice Cream Suit.
Oh, wow, Ray Bradbury.
The Ray Bradbury film.
Stuart Gordon, yeah.
And Stuart Gordon directed. People know Stuart Gordon for The Reanimator.
Which
is a hell of a film.
I love it.
But they don't know that he comes out of theater. He has a very interesting background, and he's not a one-trick pony who just made a great horror movie. Wonderful Ice Cream Suit has this just killer cast.
Joe Mantegna, Eddie Olmos. Mm-hmm. That's when I got to work with Sid and Howard, Sid Caesar and Howard Morris.
Yeah.
What a treat. I mean, I was so blessed and fortunate to have my grandfather and my family in general regards to the movie business, just to give me the education on who Sid Caesar is, who Howard Morris, and the show of shows and things of that nature, and have the privilege of learning who all these badasses were that so many young actors today don't even know.
It breaks my that part breaks my heart. Yeah.
But when I check, there are many credits before that. And you're even in Menace to Society.
Yeah, the Hughes Brothers first
film. Yeah.
They couldn't even drink. They were 19 when we did that.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Oh, gosh, but there's a lot of people who sort of were coming up the ladder there. Jada Pinkett is in that movie.
Sure.
Sam Jackson is in that movie.
Yeah, I love Sam and Jimmy in that scene. Mm-hmm.
And Bill Duke and Charles S. Dutton. Incredible cast. Who impressed you? Like when you're on a set and you're still learning and you're still growing as an actor, you obviously had to pay attention. You had to be observing what these other guys were doing and guys and girls were doing.
For sure.
Who impressed you?
I became like a little thief in the night with these old performances. I mean, everybody from Marlon Brando in Waterfront to James Dean to Monty Clift to, I love watching, The Lost Weekend, but Ray Milan. Mm-hmm. I love studying him. Mm-hmm. You know, there is so many, but more of my contemporaries, I'd say, I loved one of like Gary Oldman and Sid and Nancy.
Mm. Right.
You know, I literally just started to study some of these performances. Gary specifically, and I got to congratulate him for his amazing performance that he just won the Golden Globe for. He's become a friend. He was just somebody I just watched and studied. And any opportunity to steal from any of these greats was I'm literally glued. I can't blink when I watch a movie. I literally have to watch every beat and moment. Like, oh, when he put his glass down, he looked over here and did this, tipping off, da-da-da-da, I'm stealing that. You know, it's like, oh, there it is. Woo, and I'm just treasure hunting. It's all I'm doing.
Well, that's
and I love it.
That's great.
Much fun.
How about on a set in the moment?
Sam Jackson on 187 was such I'd say probably one of the greatest mentors next to my grandfather, who taught me so much. He's got the capacity to one learn everybody's lines in a screenplay just effortlessly. I mean, he reads the script 3 times and sorry, the whole thing's memorized. Huh. So it's just fascinating to know every, he taught me how to expand my capacity. Mm-hmm. And that was, it was a very interesting time where it was actually the fifth day of rehearsals. And Kevin Reynolds, we were talking about a scene and I was going to play with it a little bit and keep it loose. And I looked at Sam. I said, what about you, man? He says, you know what you're going to do? You're going to just kind of play around with it? I said, I like to be spontaneous, I said. And he goes, oh, spontaneity, huh? I said, yeah. I says, how about you? He says, nah, man. I says, what, you already know what you're doing? He says, yeah. I said, so what you probably went through every little different way to do the scene that would mean to me. And he would say, exactly. And then I looked at him again going, oh, holy shit. Like, I know how much research it takes me to go through a scene and every option I have, it's going to take me days. Yeah. I said, that's a lot of work. And he just looked at me kind of nonchalantly and just kind of just nodded his head and said, yeah. I was like, holy shit. That's when I took my bong and I dumped it. And I said, look at you. You're going to be a vase for the next 3 months. I'm not smoking you or touching you at all. Sorry. I'm going to clean you out and put some flowers in you. Stuck it on top of my fridge, folded up my weed and put it away, which all my other actor friends came and smoked it all because they knew I wasn't smoking it. I was like, damn, you're going to leave me nothing. I was sober for like 2.5 months, 3 months. But I just wanted to keep up with Samuel. I knew I wouldn't be by his side because his work level is just up there, but I was going to do my best to just at least try to give him a run for his money. And that in itself was a beautiful creative challenge.
Well, it's a challenge and an inspiration at the same time, isn't it?
It certainly was.
Wow. Wow.
And then also Samuel helped me, get he championed the whole cause for getting a star for my grandfather.
God bless him. That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. He's quite a guy.
He's very special. Yeah.
He's quite a guy. I'm, again, looking at so many films and TV shows. The first one I found that really struck me because of the character you played is The Replacement Killers, because you play a character named Loco. And I'm looking down the list, and it's not the only time you play
a character named Loco. More than one Loco in your life.
Yeah, I'm a little Loco. As I was wearing my shirt, I'm trying my best. It's this crazy motherfucker rehab.
Spreading the word.
Exactly.
Yes.
You don't have to fool anybody. It's okay. It's okay.
I got my SAG card. It's my loony license to get out of that insane asylum.
So, how do you balance that study and that focus with the spontaneity you still want to bring to a performance?
You know, preparation, and mm-hmm. exploration. You know, you do want to have some kind of spontaneity. You don't ever want to memorize emotion, because mm-hmm. once you memorize emotion with your dialogue, then it's curtains. You can't be directed at all. So I like to explore while I commit to memory. Mm-hmm. You know, so I kind of kill two birds with one stone, and mm-hmm. it keeps it interesting for me, so I don't get bored. Mm-hmm. And then on the day, depending on what kind of actor you're working with and director, and I try to be very conscious of that and aware. I do my homework and my research, and you know, and with the right team, and you can stay there and have a little spontaneity. I personally love rehearsals. I don't care if we have money or no money. Like, I'll find a way to get some rehearsal done. Mm-hmm. You know, I think a lot of actors today don't want to rehearse. Mm. I think they're afraid of, like, oh, I got to use that one time for the film. It's like, well, if you got the goods, you got the good. And if you don't, then you don't.
They're afraid they're going to stale?
Yeah.
But see, but that's also, you were raised by old school people. Mm. And so you're not afraid of work.
Yeah.
And you're not afraid to put in that effort because it's something special. And that's the thing is, I feel like, everyone that we've spoken to, people who either grew up with those actors, were close to those actors, or are from generations, you know, your grandmother, your great-grandmother, whoever, it's like they just have this different mentality. They have this wonderful old-school mentality.
And work
that
ethic.
I wish more of the actors today would think about.
Yeah.
I got to say, it's really interesting, and it's been great just listening to these stories again from my grandmother and getting the great details that I'm able to get now as a result of typing everything out at night. Mm. But you know, I hear their trials and tribulations. It's like, I've got nothing to complain about. Nothing. Don't talk about being overworked, Clifton. You just sound like a fool compared to your grandparents.
So you have an agent, you know, and they present you. He or she presents you with opportunities or offers as they come along. And someone says, so in Traffic, you have a chance to play a gay Mexican hitman. How's that strike you?
Oh, amazing. Because I love this one. Because they actually wanted me to audition for Manolito, which that ended up being Jacob Vargas's role, mm-hmm. who just kills it. You know, him and Benicio's partners are amazing in this. So I was shooting Tigerland at the time, and it was Debbie Zane that cast that. They must have called me four or five times to put myself on tape. And I was like, look, I don't want to just play Manolito for Soderbergh. But it's Soderbergh. I'm like, I understand it's Soderbergh. But in my eyes, I'm trying to – I need – just Clifton, the artist, needs more complicated characters to mm-hmm. keep my brain working properly. Yeah. And what better way to do that than like, wow, a gay – coke addicted Mexican hitman for the cartel who's based off a real guy. So I said, I want to play this. And they kept saying, nope, that role's already taken. And on my last day on Tigerland, which was Colin Farrell's first film, mm-hmm. I got a phone call from my manager at the time. And he says, you're not going to believe who called. I said, who's Debbie Zane? Traffic. I said, oh, wow. I says, what this time? He goes, it's for Frankie Flowers. Like, what? I was like doing backflips in my little single slider honey wagon. I said, but you got to audition on Saturday. I said, I'll audition at 3:00 in the morning on a Sunday. I don't care. You name the time and place. I will be there bright eyed and bushy tailed. And I'm going to body slam this bitch. You know, I wanted this so bad. I could smell it and taste it. I was dying to play Frankie Flowers.
How neat.
Yeah.
And you did?
I went that Saturday. That's the word on the street. Thank you for saying it.
That's so fun. I love that.
Yeah. Well, what happened was Lake Wazama had found out it had the offer. I'm a huge fan. He's a dear friend. He's like a brother to me. And Moulin Rouge went over 2 months.
Ah, okay.
And that's what opened up the door for me. But that came as a result of me sticking to my gun. Because sure. Who doesn't want to be in a Soderbergh film? Please.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was difficult. It wasn't easy for me to say no. Trust me. Yeah. I had to stick by it and say no. I was playing the lead Southern character in Tigerland.
Yeah.
So that opened up the door. I was like, well, I can play almost any Mexican now after the Southern character. It kind of wipes the slate. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to be careful what you chum the waters with and what you put out there. Yeah. And I like to put a variety of stuff. If I haven't done a gangbanger in a while, well, just like Cagney and, you know, White Heat,
yeah.
You know, I'm ready to do another gangster role, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
But it's got to be the right one.
Yeah. Sure.
You know?
What did you say? You were listening to an interview he did, and he says, I can play Mexican, but I can also play Puerto Rican. That's the
and Cuban.
Right? Name anyone at all, and you got this. No, well, the thing is, we were talking about this, both you and your grandfather, because you were twins, you don't have a stereotypical Mexican face. Your face, your bone structure can mean that you play any number of some kind of ethnic, but you've also played just sort of straight-laced, he could be anything and it doesn't matter. And that's incredible to me. You can just sort of do whatever you want in race, ethnicity, whatever, doesn't necessarily have to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And that...
It took a lot of work to get there.
I'm sure it did.
Of course.
Sure,
so you paid your dues more than 10 times over, I would say.
Who do you always see when you go on auditions?
Well, nowadays, hardly anybody. I feel like just the lone wolf walking into an audition. And that's how I feel, too. I always kind of halfway in character when I walk in there. Yeah. It's a chance to perform. And if you really love performing, like people are like, I hate auditioning. Well, do you love performing? Because you have a chance to perform.
Wow.
And, you know, you're looking at it as a chance to get a job, and sure, but the love of what you do, the craft should come first and foremost.
Yeah.
Sure, we all want to get a job.
Yeah.
But if you really love performing and it's a passionate a role that you're looking at, a role that you're passionate about, then why give
a
great performance?
Sure.
Why don't you reap the rewards of a great performance and leave their jaw on the ground? Maybe you're not a name, but the job's, you know, you want to stay relevant. You want to keep making new fans and keeping the old fans that you have.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And to do that, you got to, you know, entertain the pants off of them.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could say that in this temperature today.
Oh, sure. Please.
Entertain the
please,
pants off of me.
What I find interesting, too, is connections. The other thing that happens is you get to know people and people get to know you, obviously.
Yes,
you mentioned Deborah Zane, top casting director. And, you know, once she knows you, she knows you.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with directors and producers. So when you got a gig on a single episode, I think, of Alias.
Mm.
Back in 2001.
That was a 3-character episode arc.
Oh, it was 3? Okay.
Based off of Frankie Flowers.
Huh.
Really?
And JJ, my sister, had married my co-star from 187, Jonah Rooney. So she became Veronica C. Rooney instead of Veronica Collins.
Mm-hmm.
And then she approached me and she's like, so I want to talk to you about something. I was like, whenever she says that, I know I'm in trouble somehow. I was like, yes, yeah, sis. She's like the voice of reason, for better or worse. Usually the better. I hate to admit. She goes, look, I know you don't really do television, but you need to do this. I'm like, what are you talking about? He goes, I just want you to do this role on Alias. JJ, like, wrote it for you. I'm like, JJ? You're going to know exactly who he is. He's a family man. He's an amazing artist. He's a great filmmaker. He's going to make great movies, and you need to just buckle up and do this. I'm like, sis, well, you're talking crazy right now. I'm not doing television. Like, it was all snooty. I must suffer for my craft and do indies.
Now, this is 2001.
Yep.
And it's before this sort of renaissance
yes,
of television.
HBO and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So continue.
So my sister's like, he wrote this role based off of Frankie Flowers. Like, oh, wow, how beautiful. He goes, and he wants you to play it. And he said, gosh, is he even doing television? And I said, he'll do it. I said, what, sis? Because I already told him you're going to do it. I'm like, ah. I said, all right, fine. And then the rest is history.
Because, again, to explain to people who don't know the business or recent history of the business,
sure.
There was a time when it was considered slumming for a movie actor to do television.
Mm-hmm.
And it could hurt your career because once you made that jump, they might not consider you for feature films again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so it was risky in that sense.
Yeah, I remember my grandfather telling me, oh, Mijo, I can't go back and forth and do both. I don't know. Can't do that. But then when times are tough and you need to work and you need to feed
you
your family,
you do it.
And then Mr. Abrams remembered you.
He did. He called me to offer me
when
the
he was
role.
Making that Star Trek movie.
Yeah, the little movie that could.
So things pay off in different ways.
They did. He's an amazing. I mean, he's a special guy too.
Yeah.
He called my sister when our grandfather passed, and he's just a very kind.
How long has he been gone?
Since 2006.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Huh. So if I were to ask most people your most, what they consider your most memorable role, I bet 4 out of 5 would say Perry Smith and Capote.
Quite a few would say Capote. But I, honestly, at this point in my career, I kind of have to profile my fans.
Yes.
And I'm not always right. You know, mm-hmm. just like the cops. so, but I do profile, and it helps you get out of situations, you know. But again, sometimes I'm totally wrong. I mean, sometimes they're huge fans of the Stone Age, or they're fans of 187, or they're mm-hmm. fans of the indies like Road Dogs, or yeah. fans of The Last Castle.
Yeah.
You know, there's just...
there's a lot to choose from.
I was going to say, yeah, there's a lot to choose from. And you look at somebody, you go, what would you watch?
And then sometimes I forget myself. People are like, oh, and they just start reciting dialogue of mine. I'm just looking at them like they're a crazy person. Like, that's what you said. I'm like, I did? And then you tell me the movie, and it's like, oh my God, what an idiot. I forgot. Yes.
I don't think you're an idiot if you can't remember all of your dialogue from all of your... But this is one of those fascinating things where it's true. In the same way that if someone's on TV for a long time, you let them into your living room every week, so you feel this connection, even though you've never met.
Mm.
It's the same thing if you're in a movie people love. People love Scott Pilgrim.
There's another one.
And that's one of those things where I've had people, if I show them your photo and I say, you know, what's the first film? Inevitably, it's like, oh, my God, that scene with Thomas Jane in Scott Pilgrim. It was hilarious. And so you don't know. It could be anything. And it's true. My dad was trying to remember what this, and I said, it's Vegan Police. He's the two of them are the Vegan Police in Scott Pilgrim. But it's incredible. And for me, I think it is Capote. Because we saw it in Telluride at the film festival.
Oh, wow.
Philip Seymour Hoffman was there.
Yeah.
And
Bennett Miller.
And it was one of those where I was so in love with him, with Philip Seymour Hoffman. I have been forever. And I was so excited to meet him. And to see this movie, which really messes with your head, was so exciting. And then to see you do something that I hadn't really seen you do before.
A killer. Kill.
A killer, but it messes with your head because...
You have empathy for him.
You have empathy for him. You feel so many things for him. Mm. And you believe him. And you believe everything he tells you. And then, I mean, that's the movie. I won't say anything about the movie.
No, it's pretty chilling.
Seen it, but like,
pretty chilling stuff.
That's one of those things. So there you are next to a group of really talented actors, and you're holding your own, and you're scaring the shit out of me. So that's the one that pops in my head. Definitely that one.
And one of the other miracles of that movie, of course, is Philip Seymour Hoffman is playing Truman Capote, who was a very diminutive man, which Philip was not. And yet he, you know, he just makes you believe that he is that guy.
Yeah.
Not just the voice and the demeanor, but he puts him across. So what was it like working opposite him in the scene?
It was quite fantastic. I first met Philip through John Ortiz when Philip was getting ready to play Dusty in Twister.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd been friends ever since. You know, Philip was heavier set.
Yep.
He had a very deep baritone voice, mm-hmm. and he was going completely against type.
Yeah.
So it was great to, one, get to rehearse with actors the way I want to rehearse, because they're all New Yorkers.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Futterman, Bennett, Philip, all those guys were all New Yorkers. So to sit there with Philip while we're watching Capote on the various late-night talk shows mm-hmm. and just studying him, it was just fun. You know, it was fun. It's such a great tool to have those resources. And there was nothing like that for Perry Smith. I believe there's a recording of Dick Hickok's confession. So any chance and opportunity to have a tool where you're able to hear a character's voice, his cadence, you know, the tonation, the timbre, you know, when they choose to pause, you know, mm-hmm. and just reading into that. Is the same way I would use. I was very fortunate to receive, I think I got like maybe, I want to say 38, 40 to 40 copies of some of the letters that Perry wrote to Capote while he was in jail.
Wow. So I know most folks know the story, but this is the real life murder case in Kansas that inspired Truman Capote to write what was then a groundbreaking book, what he called a nonfiction novel, I think, which was a true story told with a novelist's skills, the art of a novelist as a storyteller. And it was made before under its original name, In Cold Blood, in the late 60s. And Robert Blake played the part of Perry Smith, one of the two killers. Scott Wilson played the other. And so people had visited this turf before. And then there was another Capote movie that came out, you know.
With Daniel Craig, you know, with Daniel Craig.
And, but you guys, and they're all good. There's, you know, there's no point in comparing because they're all good because the story is so great and the work that everybody did was so superior. But man, you just sent chills down our spine. Mm. No question of that.
I appreciate that.
And then, now, then you got to work with another terrific director. You got to work for Iñárritu Alejandro in Babel. And you're not in it a lot, but you're there.
It was, to work, there's the trilogy, Guillermo and Pedro and Alejandro, like the trilogy of, in my opinion, are the genius directors. He pitched me Babel, and I was doing Little Chenier, playing a Cajun boy named T-Boy down the bayou, Nesha. I was playing that guy when Alejandro called me, and I was in the middle of a thunderstorm, and he's pitching me. It's like the scene in the movie with the man who tapes the hash to his stomach. I said, "Oh, Brad Davis." He goes, "Yes, that man, that cabron." And he's pitched me in the pressures of the police coming onto the plane and da-da-da-da. It's Midnight Express. Mm. And I says, "Wow," I says, "these are all beautiful beats you're presenting to me, Alejandro, but this isn't the scene in your script." He goes, "Ah, cabron," he goes, "you're right." But Alejandro's filled so much passion. I was like, "I know we're going to do this together." I said, "I've got some ideas. I've written them down." He goes, "Ah, cabrón." He goes, "Well, I will fix it for you." I said, "Great." I said, "Well, he's got so much passion. I'm in on passion
alone. Whatever it is.
Whatever it is." That's exactly what it was.
Yep.
But then when I got there, he's like, "Hey, Alejandro," I looked at the scenes and they're all the same. He goes, "Ah, cabrón, I forgot. I've been so busy." I was like, "Oh, fucker." I said, "All right." And then day two passed. "Hey, Alejandro, we're getting ready to shoot this." He goes, "Ah, cabrón, I chingao." I said, "All right, I got some ideas for this stuff. I've been talking to my cousin who's a cop. He's a sergeant at Oakland, and he gave me more or less the beats and the breakdowns of how these things would happen. So I presented a few different situations and versions of that scene, and I just shot them to him. I said, "You just want me to write these out for you, bro?" And I was like, "Oh, si, por favor, if you can, it'd be great." I said, so I did, and I gave it to him, and that's what's in the movie.
Oh, my.
Yeah. Oh,
and he still doesn't know. And he still has no clue what happened.
I loved working for Alejandro. Just as Guillermo, both of them is just
two of them together.
They're rascals.
Oh my
they're
god!
Rascals.
Yes. Like, oh my god!
Because you got to work with Guillermo del Toro in Pacific Rim.
Yeah,
which is a whole different animal altogether. But he is just so he is larger than life.
He's like our modern day Hitchcock, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And his love for film is just, it transcends so much.
Yeah.
It really, yeah.
We tell people a lot, if you've never heard him speak about film, either go see it in person somewhere, see him speaking somewhere, or look it up online, because holy crap.
I mean, buy his films with the commentaries.
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because they literally double up. You'll watch a commentary and be like, "Gosh, I don't know if I like the movie better or the movie with the commentary." Like, you're going to have...
He makes any movie better.
You feel like you're hanging out with a friend.
Yep.
Yeah.
He makes any movie better.
Really does.
Yeah. There's one film that in this period that most people wouldn't cite because it's a film that kind of came and went. But Jesse and I are big fans of Sunshine Cleaning.
Oh, so good.
We really like that movie. And in this year of the woman that we're in, that was written and directed by women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Christine Jeffs directed it, and Megan Holly wrote it. And it stars Amy Adams and Emily Blunt, who were not yet, they're on the cusp of stardom.
Yeah.
And you have a terrific part in that movie. And it just seems like a little movie that could use that term before, but this really is.
This really was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, my manager talked me into this one. It was, you got to be careful when you play any I think as an actor, we have a responsibility to convey the truth for the people that are in this. And having friends that are amputees, like, I wanted to have an honesty with that character. And I had questions, you know. On indies, you have such a micro budget that you don't have room for a lot of things. And when you hire the right actors, they're going to do what they can to bring whatever they need and to make this character come to life, money or no money.
You play a sympathetic character, which you don't always get to do. And who helps these two women who are trying to start this crazy idea of a business, cleaning up crime scenes. And you run a hardware store, I think?
I sell the chemicals necessary to clean up the homicide scenes.
So you're really a good guy who gives them a boost when they need it. And that could be a one-dimensional character, but not the way you play it.
No, I appreciate that. There was a lot of down to the exact design of that character, from the ponytail to the glasses, the patterns in the shirt. This is all stuff that I got down with on the hair and wardrobe and and makeup people. And, you know, I was just really concerned how that arm's going to move. You know, I said, you know, an amputee, because it didn't specify in the script, is it below the elbow or is it below the shoulder? Because if it is below the shoulder, you're going to have a nub. And that nub is going to move when I go to hug you or I go to grab. It doesn't know that the arm's missing. So it's going to move. So how are we going to convey that? So there's all these different questions and things that they hadn't really thought about. So it was really imperative that we did that. And also, it was just great. The crew was just so collaborative and on the same page with me. And working with Amy and Emily, I mean, who doesn't want that gig to end? Yeah. I don't care if it's scale or SAG deferred, you know, keep me. Let's do the sequel and the follow-up third one as well. I'm here. You got me.
That's great. Well, as I say, we're boosters for that film.
Yes.
Sunshine Cleaning. If you haven't seen it, you should, because it's really entertaining.
It's the same producers that did Little Miss Sunshine, which won the Oscar earlier that year.
They only do films with the title Sunshine. That's their specialty.
All about shedding light and love.
And you have also done a run of TV series in this past decade, and I wonder, and most of them haven't had long runs.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it like? What's your gut feeling about these shows? Do you ever have a sense of when they're going to fly and when they're not? I mean, you did The Event with Jason Ritter, which was only one season, and Red Window with Rhoda Mitchell, and Cleaners with Emmanuel Trieke and Emily Osment, and you were in the first season of Ballers, which is still alive and well, and Westworld, which is still alive and well. But so some take and some don't. Do you ever have a buzz inside you saying, "Oh, this is gonna go"?
You know, you always hope for the best and expect the worst.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't help but think that this platform's kind of been waiting for Westworld for me to kind of jump in and flirt. Because Lisa Joy sat me down and pitched me this character after they'd already shot the pilot, so I wasn't even a part of the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were already done with it. When they brought me in, and just the way things kind of came together, it's like in my 27, 30-year career, I haven't had a chance to do a Western, which is so strange, in my opinion, being that my grandfather's almost entire career was built upon Westerns.
Sure.
You know, it's what he loved. It's what he did. It's what he would breathe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So to have an opportunity to work with such trailblazers like J.J. and Jonah Nolan and Lisa Joy and all the showrunners are on board is such an honor and a privilege. I feel like I'm almost stepping in, dare I say, my grandpa's genre.
Because
I haven't been privy to that this whole time. I mean, I met on Magnificent Seven. I met on a couple other Westerns, 310 to Yuma. You know, I was at Glenn Ford's funeral, like around that same time I was auditioning for 310.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause my grandfather did The Sheepman with Glenn.
Right.
So they were dear friends. I got letters from Glenn as well, so I kind of felt, ooh, this is all little signs. But in this one, this is almost kind of an effortless union, and I'm surrounded by actors I admire and respect, and my entire crew, they all work so hard, and we all know we're, you know, fighting the clock and, you know, resources and money and this and that, but there's so much passion behind everybody on set that, you know, you're all doing this together, and I can't quite articulate what that specialness is, but there's something very like we're all meant to be together. And the fact that I get to wear my grandfather's gum belt. And
You were telling us about that when we saw you in Austin. Yeah. And you were talking about like specifically what you wanted to choose, what you wanted to have on you. It's really cool.
That's great.
It's really cool. Yeah. You get to do that.
Good for you. Good for you. Now, you got to work with a director I know you really wanted to work with, Terrence Malick.
Oh, my God.
On Knight of Cups.
Yeah.
With a killer cast. Talking about killers. But it is. I mean, it's just an unbelievable roster of people. But you had to ditch another job to do it.
I did. I had to ask gracefully and as politely as possible to be written out of an episode of Red Widow. Mm-hmm. And my manager at the time said, Clifton, look, so Malick's called and they want you to be in this follow-up film after Knight of Cups. I was like, oh my God, Malick again, he calls, shit. He goes, but there's a catch. I'm like, what? He goes, you got to fly yourself to Austin. I'm like, all right. They're only paying you scale. I'm like, all right. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what's the catch? I'm like, he goes, I knew you'd still want to do it. So I said, you want to do it. We got to get you written out of this. And then the producer's like, Clifton, look, we're going to write you out. We understand it's Terrence Malick, but you got to understand, we can't pay you for this episode. I'm like, great. Oh my God, I love you guys. Thank you. So I lost like $45,000 or $50,000 just to make $600 to work with Malick. But goddamn, it's fucking Malick. Hell yeah. Sign me up. I'm in. And then it was beautiful because I got to see, you know, as soon as they brought me to set, it was with Benicio again from Traffic and then Natalie Portman from Brothers and Michael Fassbender. And I had all these relationships already in place. Yeah. So to see everybody, it was kind of like, hey, you finally got here. And everybody's hugging me and we're laughing. And last time I saw Natalie was Heath Ledger had passed and I was in my trailer crying because he was a dear friend of mine. And I was supposed to, we were supposed to hook up like a week earlier for reshoots on Batman in Chicago. Mm-hmm. We missed each other and she literally just came in and just like held me for like half hour while I just sobbed. Wow. And that was the last time I saw her. I hadn't seen her since. That was like, I was like, thank you so much just for just knowing, being sensitive to that whole thing.
Wow. Well, what experiences?
Well,
what
that's, incredible I was trying experience. To think of who you haven't worked with, actor-wise, director-wise, because I feel like, have you done an episode of Barney? Maybe that's the only thing you're missing.
No.
Have you ever appeared with the big purple dinosaur?
No, but I want to do something with Samuel again, Sam Jackson. Oh, yeah. Let's kind of find something. Cool.
Well, we haven't yet talked about your newest film, which opens today.
Oh, the premiere.
As this episode.
Yes, premieres tonight.
As this episode breaks online. You are in a really neat little kind of a retro film.
Yeah. It's already on demand, by the way.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You can watch it on demand.
I watched it on DirecTV.
Oh, beautiful.
That's how you watched it.
There you go.
Because that was how it was available to me on a timely basis. And it's called Small Town Crime. And it's got just a wonderful cast.
Amazing.
Starting with John Hawkes, who I love. And Anthony Anderson and Octavia Spencer and Robert Forster,
my God.
And Michael Vartan, on and on and on and on down the line. It's a very modest film, and it's not trying to be something it's not. That's what I like about it, you know? It's kind of an old pulpy crime picture, crime thriller, about a guy who has messed up his life, played by John Hawkes, in need of redemption. And you play a character with the one wonderful name of Mood. And you have a great look and a great presence. And you drive a muscle car.
62 Impala. Tricked out with hydraulics.
Hydraulics? Mm. Did you get to do the...
Of course.
Of course. I guess he hasn't seen this yet.
You can't put a Mexican in a hydraulic car.
I mean, right?
The switches.
You can't hit
the...
Oh, man.
Yeah.
One of the security guards at my school growing up had one of those bounce, and then when he parked and turned off, the whole thing lowered down. And I went to the whitest white school, so all of us kids are like, "What is that? Nice. That is magical!" Oh,
love it.
Oh. Anyway, so must have been fun working with all those good people. How did you hook up with the Nelms brothers, who wrote and directed the film?
You know, this was at a strange time in my career where I fired my manager and I fired one of my agents, and I was kind of floundering. And I was really blessed to have a couple films come my way just through directors calling me directly, through other friends that knew directors that had worked with me.
Wow.
So they called me. That's how they got a hold of me. Mm-hmm. And then I went through the script. I made some, you know, I, I've got a little knowledge of that hood background, so I just off the cuff, I made my notes and I sat down with them and I ran some ideas by them. You know, that whole look was something that I came up with, down to the gold teeth, which I brought from home, of course, because I knew they wouldn't have the money to get my gold teeth done. And then I sat down with an old neighborhood friend of mine, because this guy was supposed to be kind of like a black pimp. And I was like, have you guys ever read Iceberg Slim's book? And they're like, no. I'm like, okay. All right, cool. Well, I know where I'm at now. Let me do my research and I'm going to present you guys with some stuff. And I sat down with one of my old Crip friends that I've been a friend of mine since I was 15. And we went through all the dialogue, all of it. And that was fun to just reconnect with him and do all of that stuff. And then the brothers loved it.
Well, you know, they'd be dumb not to, I venture to say. Truly, I mean, as a filmmaker, you're bringing them a gift.
Yeah.
You're giving them a gift. You're giving them a gift of not just you and your performing ability, but your dedication to
your
getting
time,
it right.
Your passion.
To really giving layers to this character. Yeah. Not just what's on the script page, but so much more. And you know, they ought to kiss the ground you walk on, man, for doing that on a little indie picture.
Yeah, it was a good time. It was interesting trying to convey the hairstyle, because the beanie was something that I came up with too, which is very kind of a cultural thing. But in regards to when I was actually flossing and flexing, I've got that finger wave haircut. It's like, you know, I wanted to say a modern day pimp, and the woman that was doing my hair was like in her 70s, and didn't really know what I was talking about. I'm like, finger waves from the flappers in the 20s and 30s. And he's like, oh, now I know what you mean. How do you do that? And I said, well, it's like da 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 da. She's like, and then she started getting down, and I saw her come to life as an artistic, you know, just an artist in her own right. And
sure.
She's a hair girl, and she's an artist. And once I fed her that, I just saw her light up, and she just went to town. I was like, yes, yes, here, boom, 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 and we started doing it. And she was so excited when she saw it all come together. And it was really dope for me as an actor to watch, you know, a hairdresser be just as excited about a character.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I really hope your memoir is called Flossin' and Flexin'. That is really what I hope happens at some point.
You heard it here today.
Flossin' and Flexin'.
Flossin' and Flexin'.
Well, that's, again, it shows, you know, the audience isn't supposed to think about any of this.
Mm-mm.
That's not what it's about. They're just supposed to watch the film, take it in, enjoy it, maybe learn from it, maybe be stimulated or inspired in some way, or certainly be entertained. So it's not anybody's job to think about what goes into making that entertainment. We, because we're buffs and because we love the process and because the people who listen to us on this podcast, I think, share our love for all of that, listen to someone like you and we go, wow. It just, you know, you don't think about that. And then you wonder, why is it as good as it is? That's why it's as good as it is. That's why that performance, that's why that character pops off the screen. There's a reason.
Mm.
It's 'cause what you put into it. So, bravo.
Well, thank you.
And what's next?
Well, we just wrapped season 2 of Westworld.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very excited about that. And getting down with Ed Harris again has been such a beautiful mentoring joy. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's just a bad motherfucker. He's like 65 years old, jumping on this horse, and
I love him.
He gets bent out of shape when the stuntmen are going to ride. He goes, "What?" And he goes, "You mean the kid and I worked all day, and we don't get to ride our horses into town?" You know? And I'm just looking at him like, maybe that's a good thing, Ed. I don't say that. I don't dare say that. He goes, "What do you think about this kid?" And he goes, "Let's ride these horses." I'm like, "I'm going to do what you do, Ed." You know, cut to, I'm on the horse. Inside, I'm screaming like a little girl. But on the outside, I'm cool as shit. I'm just like, yeah.
Yeah,
but on the
horse.
Inside, I'm like, we got stuntmen to do this. Ed, why are we doing this? You know, he's a 65-year-old man. He's jumping on the horse. I'm going to do whatever Ed does. And I'm going to, you know, work hard to be just as good. I'm going to try to be better. And I think that's the goal, is just to have that place where you can constantly be inspired by someone like Ed and the people that surround you and strive for being better. Or, dare I say, greatness. I don't know if I ever achieved that, but to strive for it is important.
It sure is.
I love those moments when you hear an actor talking about something like that, where the other guy's like, "Yeah, yeah, let's do it, okay." And you hear somebody go, "I didn't know. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know. I did." The first thing that comes to my mind is Jonah Hill in Wolf of Wall Street. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm.
He was going to get punched in the face for real.
Oh.
And he's looking at, so Scorsese says to him, "What about if he just hits you for real?" And Jonah Hill's like, "No." And he's looking at Leonardo DiCaprio. Leonardo DiCaprio turns around. He's like, "You motherfucker." He just left him. He's like, "Yeah, you can just, yeah. Hit him in the face. Yeah. And I just think, oh my God, for any of you, especially when you're working with people you respect and for someone you respect, you're going, "Yeah, I'll ride this horse. Yeah, I'll totally ride this horse."
Well, yeah. Ed's doing it.
You have to.
Yeah.
You know, you have to. Like, come on, he's 20 years my senior. How am I going to puss out on this one?
The ultimate in peer pressure. There you go.
But he's not even pressuring me.
No, of course not.
He just looks at me. He's like, "You okay with this?" Kid, like, "Hell yeah, I'm okay.
Yeah, I
wouldn't have it any other way."
Yeah. Like, "Clifton, are you crying?" No.
No. The hay got in my eyes.
Mm.
Oh, there's so much hay on this set.
There's a bit dusty. Yeah, that's
so
all it is.
So much dirt and ash.
Well, so you've had your baptism of fire as a Western actor.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Is your grandma just thrilled?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Aww. And season 2 is going to blow your mind. I can't articulate what we've done this year. It's mind-blowing.
That's great.
So cool.
Well, we wish you continued success and continued reward for the effort you put in and the love you put into what you do. And I know your grandfather is smiling. I just know it. And give our love to your grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And wish
90
her well.
90 years old.
Yeah, and wish her well.
90 years old, and she doesn't know she's 90.
Nope, run around like a 70-year-old.
Well, you know, 70 is the new 90.
It is.
90 is the new 70. Like, 90 is the new 70. I had it
backwards. Yeah. We'll go with that. Yeah.
She's like 4'7".
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's good to see you guys. Yeah.
Great to see you too. And Jesse, are you a social media guy?
He is.
Where do people find you? Or how do people find you?
I'm on Instagram. I'm at Mr. Whoopass, MrWuppass.
It's my favorite thing.
And then on Twitter, I'm at C. Collins Jr.
Okay.
But I like Mr. Whoopass.
But that's not your handle, is it, Jesse?
It's not. I'm at Jesse Malton, and you're at Leonard Malton.
Mm-hmm. Very conventional.
Both Twitter and the Instagram. Yeah. I will tell you folks, though, Clifton posts the most fantastic photos on Instagram of his family, as in his granddad. Because a little while ago, like over December, you posted a ton of clips and photos, and they were so fantastic. So if you are somebody who's on Instagram, go look him up. It's really, really cool to see these shots. Really cool.
Thank you.
And you can find me in the old-fashioned World Wide Web.
The interweb at leonardmalton.com.
That's true.
Full of articles and reviews and everything else you could possibly need.
It's all there.
Let your fingers do the
it's
walking.
All there. That's right. F-R-E-E, free. Anyway, thanks again, and thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.